Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, my name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. I'm today joined by James Henderson, director of the Natural Gas Programme, to discuss the key messages that came from his recent book, The Globalisation of Russian Gas, Political and Commercial Catalysts, that he co-authored with Harold Moe, a research professor at the Fridtjof Nansen Institute in Norway. James, great to have you here. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure, David, as always.
Now, the title of your book is about the globalization of Russian gas, but the first chapter actually addresses domestic gas politics. Can you perhaps tell us why this is important and what the link is to Russia's role in the global gas market?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, the link is Gazprom. Gazprom is the state-owned gas company, which basically has a huge role to play in the domestic market, but also historically has had a monopoly on pipeline gas exports. And the reason for that is that at the end of the Soviet era, Gazprom emerged out of the Ministry of Gas at a time when the Russian economy was in turmoil. Essentially, there was collapse through the early and mid-1990s. And gas accounts for such a huge part of energy supply in Russia to the economy, and it basically accounts for 50% or more of total primary energy demand, that Gazprom was a vital cog in keeping the power system going, in keeping people warm in winter. So it had a huge role in the domestic economy and therefore in domestic politics. And of course, at that time, non-payment for gas bills was a huge issue. I mean, companies were going bankrupt and people just didn't have huge amounts of money. And so non-payment was a big issue. Prices were low. They remain regulated, and they were certainly regulated back then at very low levels. Mm-hmm. And the quid pro quo from Gazprom's perspective was access to the export market. Export prices were much higher. People paid so they could receive cash. And that cash essentially, during the 1990s at least, subsidized the domestic energy economy. And so we went through a decade where Gazprom basically dominated production, supply to customers in Russia, and supply to its main export market, its only export market at the time, Europe. And so the link between domestic and export sales was via Gazprom, because essentially export sales subsidized the domestic gas market.
Yeah, I must admit, I find that 50% number absolutely huge. But what is the situation now in the current economic crisis?
Well, so now, interestingly, there is actually some competition of sorts in the domestic market. You know, companies like Novatek, Rosneft, and other oil companies have emerged, and they sell gas to domestic players. And for a while, that was quite interesting, because you know, competition was emerging, and it became obvious that the Russian government wasn't just Gazprom that could essentially operate successfully in the domestic market. I mean, as it happens right now during the COVID-19 crisis, the issue of non-payments has started to re-emerge, because the government has essentially told customers that they can defer payments if they're in financial trouble. But in general, the domestic market has become slightly more competitive. Essentially, it's now a triopoly. I mean, Gazprom, Novatek, and Rosneft, really the dominant players, with a number of other smaller players. But essentially, slightly more competitive, not truly competitive, and Gazprom still dominating. But I think that the interesting thing is that it has been demonstrated that competition can work, because essentially prices have been kept relatively low. And that's also being seen in the export market as well, as I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you mentioned a triopoly of those three companies. So do you think we'll ever see a truly competitive market in Russia?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. And the answer in the short term is no, because there's no real incentive to create competition, because everyone's quite happy with the status quo. There have been various attempts at liberalisation, one of which mentioned in the book, it was centered around trying to develop a gas exchange in St. Petersburg on the Spymex exchange. It's interesting that the consequences of that when they worked through what would need to happen to make an exchange really work, were that you would need a fully competitive and liberalized market. And once everyone realized that, they kind of stepped back from the brink a bit, because it would have meant proper, full, transparent third-party access to the pipeline system. It would have meant a fully competitive market. It would have meant Gazprom freeing up gas for sale by third parties. The implications were very dramatic and would have effectively meant the breakup of Gazprom. And the Kremlin and others were not prepared to go that far. So I think the answer is, in the short term, no. You know, in the medium to long term, it's always an option, but I don't think it's being discussed right now, no.
No, because it's interesting, you talk about the spineless exchange. You know, so you think this is an important indicator of the future trends of the Russian gas sector, do you? This is an important step, is it?
Yes, I think it's an indicator. And unfortunately, the indicator at the moment is that nothing's happening. So, I mean, 2 or 3 years ago, there was a lot of debate about whether the gas exchange would emerge. And I think that the Spimex itself was pushing very hard. And indeed, the Federal Anti-Monopolies Commission was pushing very hard. I think that the economic crisis and now the health crisis has very much put things on the back burner. And I think Gazprom, to an extent, has adapted. You know, there's a little bit of trading on Spimax. The regulated price in Russia has remained pretty low now. Other companies have adapted to trading around that regulated price. So there's not much momentum, to be honest, to push liberalization much further. In the short term, I mean, I'd probably argue that while Putin is still president of Russia, we're unlikely to see full liberalization of the gas sector.
But do you think, therefore, and I'm kind of reading between the lines what you're saying, I think I know the answer to this is, but can Spimex actually provide the link between the domestic and the export market then?
I think not, actually, now. I mean, theoretically, yes, but what Gazprom's been doing is, setting up alternatives, which is been its modus operandi for a while. And interestingly, it's set up its own kind of electronic sales platform on the Nord Stream pipeline to allow for trading of Russian gas into Europe on a quasi sales platform.
But they refer to it as the hub, don't they?
Yeah, indeed. But it's not. I mean, our colleague Patrick Heather would not describe it as a hub. It is essentially a sales platform where Gazprom offers gas for sale on a on a regular basis to top up its long term contracts. So there's already a kind of trading link now, which has slightly undermined the plans for Spimex being that link. So I think it's still a possibility in the longer term, but I don't think we're going to see anything dramatic in the short to medium term.
But how we've mentioned the electronic sales platform. How does this link to Gazprom's ESP? How does it do that?
Well, so Gazprom essentially has its long-term contracts into Europe, which it's had for many, many years. Customers have the right to nominate volumes within take-or-pay levels. So occasionally Gazprom has surplus gas for sale. It wants to fill its pipelines, and so it can offer extra volumes for delivery to various points within Europe. And essentially people come and bid for gas. Gazprom essentially does set a minimum price, but there's a quasi auction, if you like, for surplus Russian gas, if you like, to fill capacity in pipelines. And it's interesting because it's something of an indicator of how competitive Gazprom wants to be in the European market. The more gas it offers, clearly, the more competitive it's being with alternative suppliers. So at the moment, with prices very, very low, it is interesting that the volumes have gone down on the ESP, because flooding more gas into Europe is not going to help anyone. But at times when the market is tight, and certainly, you know, at the end of 2019 and start of 2020, actually volumes were increasing on the ESP, and that was an indication that Gazprom was prepared to compete on price with alternative suppliers.
Well, that's a nice segue, James, to move into talking about the export markets for Russia's gas, because Russia, of course, its major export market has always been Europe for gas. So can you perhaps explain to us how the relationship between Gazprom and its major customers have evolved over the past decades, and really, how do things stand now?
Well, I think as the history is, you know, back to the late 1960s and the 1970s, when gas was discovered in West Siberia. When Russia kind of cooperated with European partners to provide the steel and the pipes to link those gas fields in West Siberia, initially through Ukraine, which of course was part of the Soviet Union at the time, and into Austria, Germany, and it was German companies largely that provided much of the steel and the pipe. So that link was there, and as the gas market in Europe grew through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, the huge resources in Russia became a very useful and pretty competitive source of supply. Customers were reliant on Gazprom, became increasingly reliant on Gazprom. Gazprom was a very secure supplier. There really weren't any interruptions. And a positive relationship developed over 20 or 30 years. In terms of where they things stand now, I mean, the big changes came, in the 2000s when there were concerns catalyzed by a couple of minor interruptions in supply via Ukraine within Europe about security of supply of Russian gas, as the politics started to change as well. And the European Commission decided that in order to allow the gas market in Europe to become more diversified and to make sure that customers had competitive price on offer, to liberalize the European gas market. And this is where the third energy package came in and third-party access and essentially forcing companies to not own assets all across the value chain and to obviously price their gas on a competitive gas-on-gas hubs within Europe. And so Gazprom, perhaps not surprisingly, as the major exporter into Europe at the time, obviously Norway a large one as well, but Gazprom was the largest, felt that this was kind of undermining its modus operandi, where it had always traded on long-term oil-linked contracts, and this was a complete change, and obviously it felt threatened by that. And so for a period of, I'd say, a decade, there was a significant sort of to-and-throw arguments about the way Gazprom operated, investigations by the European Commission into its competitive practices. But over a decade, I think to summarize, Gazprom essentially has been forced to adapt the way it does its business. It's been forced to comply with European Commission rules. And now we're in a situation where, having gone through a turbulent period with customers where there were arbitration cases, as customers and Gazprom argued over the way prices were set and the way contracts were phrased. Now we have a situation where Gazprom is offering a significant share of its gas at European hub prices, where contracts have been adapted to allow for more flexibility, and where essentially customers now have the option whether to buy Russian gas, Norwegian gas, Algerian gas, LNG, on a much more short-term basis, and therefore they do have that effective that diversification option, which the European Commission was after. So essentially, the European Commission has done a very good job of ensuring that customers do have choice now in the European gas market.
Well, exactly, but that must have been a bit of a threat to the whole of Gazprom's business model in Europe. So is that the case, or is Gazprom able to operate now within this new way of working?
Well, I mean, I think the irony of it was, and a number of us were arguing, that actually this actually played to Gazprom, one of Gazprom's major strengths, which is that it is a low-cost producer, and also it has a flexible exchange rate, which, again, can help with costs. When commodity prices go down, the ruble tends to weaken, which brings Russian gas costs and oil costs down as well in dollar terms. So I think that actually what happened was that although European customers were given a choice, the choice they made was actually to stick largely with Gazprom. And Russian export volumes to Europe have been reaching record levels, certainly in 2018 and in 2019, close to above in 1 year and close to 200 billion cubic meters. Now, in 2020, we're going to see that go into decline for obvious reasons. But so essentially, Gazprom found itself in a position where it had to be competitive, but also found itself in a position where it could compete. And and therefore, customers, having been given the choice, actually chose to stick with and indeed grow purchases from Russia. So actually, for Gazprom, it's worked out quite well.
Yeah. But one of the comments in your book I found quite interesting, because you say the future balance of Russia's gas export strategy may depend on outcomes in the domestic market. Could you perhaps just build upon that and tell our listeners what you meant by that line?
Well, I think that the interesting thing that's been going on in the domestic market is that, as I said earlier, competition of sorts has emerged, and Novatek and Rosneft demonstrated, if you like, that third-party suppliers could supply significant volumes to domestic customers, and also that the competition between the three of them meant that Gazprom's demands for the regulated price to go up on a regular basis actually could be demonstrated to not be necessary, because other companies, Novatek and Rosneft, were prepared to supply gas at the current price. So, the Kremlin could argue, well, why do you need a higher price, Gazprom? So I think what was interesting was that competition was demonstrated to be useful. And why is that relevant to the export market? Well, one, Gazprom had to adapt to competition in its domestic market, and therefore got some practice. And secondly, Novatek and Rosneft started to argue, well, hold on, if we're doing this good job in the domestic market, how about giving us a chance to do something in the export market as well?
As well, yes.
And when they did that, they also said, by the way, Europe's not the only market out there. Have you noticed that Asia is growing rather rapidly? And perhaps you ought to give us the chance to sell gas to Asia and not compete with Gazprom, but open up a new market for Russia.
Mm. Well, let's talk about Asia in a minute. But one thing I really want to address with you, because it appears in many articles, is the politicization of Gazprom. So I think my question is, how political has the European gas business become for Russia? And is Gazprom's business effectively driven by the Kremlin or by commercial concerns? What do you think?
Well, I think it's become political because, as I mentioned, on a commercial basis, Gazprom has been very successful, and customers, when given the choice, have bought its gas in large volumes. So if you're a European politician and you're worried about diversifying away from Russia, and you're worried about over-reliance on Russian energy, particularly gas, and particularly if you're the US looking at Europe and thinking you want to sort of, you're concerned about the influence of Russia as well, what you're looking at and seeing is that on a commercial basis, although you've offered diversity optionality, you've actually failed to diversify European gas imports. And the only thing you've got left then is politics and infrastructure. And so what we've seen is the use of European legislation to try and block Russian gas new export pipelines. And we've seen politics, I mean, not just about gas. Obviously, there's been a lot of concern about Russian actions in Ukraine, as well as in the rest of the world. But those have catalyzed sanctions, and those sanctions have been on Russian energy companies. And now on Russian gas export pipelines, particularly Nord Stream 2. Essentially, there's been a politicization driven by the fact that clearly Gazprom is a state-owned company. It has a big connection to the Kremlin, but also because gas exports are a big geopolitical and strategic issue, and therefore security of supply is a big question mark, and that means politics. So, I think in Europe, gas exports have become increasingly politicized as sanctions have kicked in, as the impact of Ukraine and obviously other countries like Syria and the political implications of that have come to the fore.
Well, why don't we start talking about some of the diversification which you referred to earlier on, especially to Asia? How rapidly is this happening, and how big is the opportunity for Gazprom?
Well, the opportunity is huge, and because the Asian gas market is growing very fast, and certainly in terms of Chinese gas demand, we've seen growth in the double digits over the past decade, annualized double digits over the past decade. So the opportunity is certainly large. The growth has been relatively slow. We're going to talk about the different types of exports in a minute, but Gazprom is essentially a pipeline company. And building a pipeline from reserves in Russia to China is a big and long-term business, and has political connotations as well. So Gazprom has reserves in the east of Siberia, which it has long wanted to connect to Asia you know, as far back as the 1990s discussion started. But because it's political, because there's huge amounts of money involved, $55 billion, as it happens to build the first pipeline from East Siberia to China, and because price negotiations always take a long time, essentially it's been a very slow process. Finally, an agreement was reached in 2014 to build the Power of Siberia pipeline from East Siberia into Northeast China. And that was completed in 2019. And we're now in the process of seeing supplies ramped up to a level of 38 BCM per annum into China. Now, that 38 BCM compares to 200 BCM of sales into Europe. So you can see it's an order of magnitude smaller. It's a big number, but it's an order of magnitude smaller. And also it's a pipeline which connects one country with one other country. So it's, you know, the political and strategic issues around that are interesting.
But it's interesting you mentioned that, dear, because I thought the real opportunity in Asia would be with LNG. You know, so what is the plan here? Because I thought Novatek was more important than Gazprom in the LNG business. So how does this play out for the Russian export strategy?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, you know, Gazprom sees that as well and has tried to develop LNG over the past 20 years. The Sakhalin 2 LNG project is there, and Gazprom does own 50%, just over 50% of that, but it was developed by Shell. Gazprom is not really an LNG company. It's a pipeline company, and its projects around LNG, Shtokman in the Barents Sea, Vladivostok LNG on the Far East Coast, and Baltic LNG, which was supposed to happen in the early 2000s, all have come to a disappointing conclusion, at least so far. And you're right. I mean, the Asian market is very much an LNG market. And I think this is a big issue for Russia. And, I think that Gazprom's failure in LNG led to, in 2013, Novatek and Rosneft both highlighting the fact that not only were they useful in the domestic market, but they could be useful in the export market as well. Yeah. And how about giving them an opportunity in LNG? And in 2013, the Russian government decided that the time had come to allow competition in export sales and therefore liberalized to an extent LNG exports, and said that for certain types of fields and for certain types of projects that had already been sanctioned as LNG projects, third-party companies, in fact, it was only Novatek and Rosneft, could develop LNG projects. And you're right, Novatek has now developed Yamal LNG, which points both at Europe and at Asia, and is becoming, arguably the most important growth vehicle in Russia's gas export strategy.
It is remarkable to look at the way that Novatek's expanded. But you mentioned Rosneft. You know, are they really interested in LNG? We haven't seen any plans necessarily driving forward as fast as Novatek, have we?
No, not at all. I mean, I think Rosneft has long, and its leader Igor Sechin, have long been in competition with Gazprom. They're both state controlled companies. Obviously, Rosneft largely an oil company, but has had a gas strategy for some time, since its privatization in 2006. And I think it saw the failure of Gazprom in the LNG business as an opportunity to capitalize. It has gas on Sakhalin Island, which Gazprom has always wanted to buy, but Rosneft always refused to sell. And when this LNG liberalization happened, one of the projects that was sanctioned, what was allowed to go ahead, was what is now called Far East LNG, which is based on this Sakhalin gas. Now, that it hasn't actually gone anywhere. Rosneft's got a lot of other things to do. With a low oil prices, it's got money to spend on keeping oil production up, never mind gas production. So Novatek has really taken the lead role, and its development of the Yamal Peninsula gas into LNG projects has really been the catalyst behind the current growth and the expected further growth of the Russian LNG business.
Interesting. Well, look, Jim, like all good things, they come to an end. So this podcast is kind of nearing the end. But before we finish, I always like to end up kind of with a thinking forward, So what are your conclusions on the future of the Russian gas sector in a global context? We haven't really talked about the energy transition. We've talked about Gazprom versus Novatek. How do you think it's going to end up? Will politics always dominate the sector?
Well, I think it'll always dominate the pipeline business. And I think that's the interesting sort of dynamic here, is that Gazprom, if you like, is always going to be a political vehicle, both domestically and in the export market. And I think in terms of Europe, you know, the commercial reality is that Russia has a lot of cheap gas, but if Europe buys too much of it, it becomes overexposed to Russian energy, and there's a security of supply issue. I think politics will continue to dominate. I think that, you know, probably the future of sales into Europe, given that Europe is one of the most aggressive regions in terms of the energy transition, is trying to move away from hydrocarbons. I suspect the future of the gas exports into Europe is maintaining a stable level, probably continuing to be dominated by Gazprom with a little bit of LNG, Russian LNG coming as well. I think Asia is a different story. I think in Asia, you know, the mere fact that the market is more, you know, LNG dominated than pipeline dominated means that you're going to see a more diversified export strategy from Russia. You're going to see Gazprom continuing to do pipelines. We've got one pipeline already and another one is under discussion. But again, it'll take a long time to do, probably not before 2030. Whereas you've got Novatek with significant plans for expansion. You've got the Arctic, where the ice is melting because of global warming, and where therefore access to the Asian market is easier from Novatek's projects on Yamal. So I think what you're going to see is the emergence of a two-pronged strategy. Gazprom continuing to do pipeline exports, trying to shift away from Europe towards Asia, but that inevitably being a very slow process. Meanwhile, Novatek, with a much more kind of aggressive development plan for its LNG business, can offer that diversification. It can offer sales. Well, obviously, LNG can go anywhere in the world. So it offers Russia that flexibility and that diversity of markets, which Gazprom as a pipeline company can't really do. Yeah. And therefore, I think Novatek becomes an increasingly strong part of the Russian export strategy. It's talking about exports, you know, of up to 100 billion cubic meters by 2030. So at that point, it becomes one of the largest gas exporting countries in the world, never mind in Russia. And I think, so I think that's the way things go. And in terms of the energy transition, you know, as we've been writing about in Oxford, in Asia, the transition is more about clean air. It's more about coal to gas switching. Clearly, there's a renewables element in every single country, but I think the future for gas in Asia is much stronger and healthier than it is in Europe. And so again, I think that just emphasizes the point that the shift to Asia is going to be a key part of Russian export strategy, and that will be led not just by Gazprom, but also by Novatek, and possibly, if Rosneft decide to get back into the gas business, then possibly by Rosneft and others as well. But I think what you're seeing at the moment is a real development of a two-tier strategy towards Asia with Gazprom and Novatek both at the fore.
Well, I have to say, James, it is a fascinating story. And not only have I really enjoyed our conversation on your book, The Globalization of Russian Gas, Political and Commercial Catalysts, may I say, actually, the book is very readable. And I would urge our listeners to buy it and read it. It's published by Edward Elgar Publishing and available from their website, which is www.e-elgar.com, or from other retailers, even found on Amazon, Jim. So I have to say it's good. Jim, thank you for your time. It's been, as always, a great pleasure to talk to you. I've really enjoyed the podcast, and I hope that you have all enjoyed listening to it too. Thank you, and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity, or China programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.